Some years back, I visited an expatriate team working in a conflict-affected context. It was a context in which Christians could not practice their faith openly. This team ran projects that expressed God's love in practical and tangible ways. Their respect, particularly for people living with disability and for people contending with intractable and extreme poverty, affirmed the dignity and worth of each human life. Their very presence by choice in that country brought hope in circumstances that most people wrote off as hopeless. Yet, as we, this team and I, talked and prayed together, they shared feelings of defeat, discouragement, and frustration. They asked, "What's the point of being here when we cannot talk about Jesus? What's the use of meeting all these physical needs while spiritual needs remain untouched?" These people's lives spoke eloquently of God's love, but their ideas about God devalued their lives and their work in their own eyes. This is one example of how our ideas about God affect how we understand life, faith, and the world. Our ideas about God also shape how we read the Bible. This morning, I'll outline two extreme opposing ideas about God and about how God works. Then we'll eavesdrop on a divine encounter mediated by a burning bush. And then we'll ask what the story we've just heard might imply about hope and hopeful discipleship. Next Sunday, we'll revisit the same encounter to explore how following Jesus today involves both taking God's authority very seriously and taking human responsibility very seriously. We'll consider some implications of that for our discipleship here at East Doncaster. Two extreme and opposing views of God. Is God non-interventionist or is God highly interventionist? Interventionist, non-interventionist. These are words we struggle to pronounce, or I do, and we don't often hear these days. But the question is often asked as if the only possible choice were between an interventionist God on one hand and a non-interventionist God on the other, one or the other with nothing in between. The question is also often framed as if it's a question of choice, of what we choose to believe about God, as if our choice determined reality, rather than it being a question of truth, what God is really like, whether we choose to believe God or not. To intervene is to get involved, to participate in events in order to prevent something from happening, in order to make something happen, or in order to change the consequences of something that does happen. Some of our contemporaries understand the concept of an interventionist God as mediated by Nick Cave. He's a musician-poet born in Wracknabeal, resident in the UK. In 1997, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds released a song that begins with a confession. He says, "I don't believe in an interventionist God, but I know, darling, it's a love song, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him not to intervene when it came to you, not to change a hair on your head, to leave you as you are. And if God felt he needed to direct you, then direct you into my arms." It is a love song that begins with a confession. So Nick Cave, or so these lyrics imply, could almost believe in an interventionist God. Almost, but not quite. The non-interventionist view of God claims that in creating the world, God set up a self-regulating system, placed us, humanity, in it, crossed the divine arms, and sat back to watch and see what happened. This view implies that while God might be curious about what happens here on earth, God doesn't really care. Those who hold this view often end up relinquishing their faith altogether or deciding that they want nothing to do with such a hands-off God. Some Christians believe that God does love us, yet act as if God intervenes only occasionally and dramatically, by creating the world in the first place, through the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and when Jesus returns to make everything right. But such non-interventionist ideas about God jar against biblical traditions that testify to God's passionate involvement with creation. We read of God delighting, grieving, getting angry, getting offended and impatient. We read of God longing for his people to love God and to love each other, to keep and care for God's good earth. We hear God's desire for shalom, for all people and all places, God's longing for total, all-encompassing well-being to be experienced by everyone and everything on earth. When we come to the Gospels, the Jesus we meet was a man who embraced life. Born among us as one of us, I don't believe he became human only to save us from the world. I believe that he wanted to become one of us, fully human, to live with us in this world. It's clear as we read the Gospels that from Jesus' perspective, we are worth hanging out with. Our joys are worth celebrating. Our bodies are worth healing. Our fears worth easing. Our failures worth grieving. Jesus enjoyed people. Jesus still enjoys people. He enjoys us. A non-interventionist view of God and an interventionist, a highly interventionist view of God at the other extreme. A highly interventionist view of God claims that God constantly and supernaturally meddles with the world, rewarding the good and punishing the evil, constantly realigning things to keep everything and everyone perfectly on track. On track according to some mysterious, magnificent, preordained plan. If we believe that that is how God acts, we start to blame God for all the suffering and injustice in the world, for everything that goes wrong. Why didn't God stop the Holocaust or Rwanda or September 11 or ISIS or the Burmese junta or the war in Ukraine? Why didn't God stop the Black Summer bushfires here, or the floods devastating Australia and many other countries right now? Why did God let COVID spread so badly and so fast? Why doesn't God save the Great Barrier Reef? Or we might ask more personally, why didn't God prevent that car crash? Why did God let that aneurysm burst? Why doesn't God relieve the relentless pain of arthritis or depression? Why did God let my loved one get dementia? Why did God let my kids go off the rails? Why did God let my marriage fail? Or why am I still single? Doesn't God know how lonely I am? Can you see how dangerous this thinking is? Not only do we start to blame God for everything, we relieve ourselves, our societies, and our ancestors of all responsibility. If God is constantly intervening to rearrange everything, if everything happens is somehow according to God's plan, then the only thing to do, the right thing to do, is to sit back and leave everything to God. Why help those in need, when God will feed the hungry, care for the orphan, defend the oppressed, comfort the brokenhearted? After all, that is what God promised. Many biblical stories testify that that is not how God works. God intervenes. God usually intervenes through and with people. We're going to listen to an episode of the Exodus story now. As you listen, Try to listen as if you are Moses. Remember his backstory, the history that accompanies him to this encounter. And then, as events, the conversation at the burning bush unfolds, try and experience it as if you're in his shoes or his bare feet, depending where you are in the story.
One day, Moses was taking care of the sheep and goats of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. Moses decided to take the sheep across the desert to Sinai, the holy mountain. There, an angel of the Lord appeared to Moses from a burning bush. Moses saw that the bush was on fire, but it was not burning up.
Now that's strange. Why isn't that bush burning up? I'd better go closer and have a look and see what it is.
When God saw Moses coming near, he called to him from the middle of the bush.
Moses. Moses.
Here I am.
Don't come any closer. Take off your sandals because you are standing on holy ground. I am the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Moses covered his face because he was afraid to look at God.
I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them cry out because of their slavery. Indeed, I know their suffering. I have come down to save them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a land that is good and broad, a land rich with milk and honey. The cry of the Israelites has come to me. I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people out of Egypt.
But who am I to go to the king and lead your people out of Egypt?
I will be with you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Then you will know that I am the one who sent you.
But if I tell the people that the God their ancestors worshipped has sent me, they'll ask, what is his name? What will I say to them?
I am who I am. That is what you will say. The one who is called I am and sent me to you. Tell the Israelites, the Lord God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations. So, go and call together the leaders of Israel and tell them, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have seen your suffering in Egypt. I will bring you out of Egypt to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to you. And you and the elders of Israel will go to the king of Egypt and say to them, let us go on a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, so that we may worship the Lord our God. But the king of Egypt will not let you go unless he is forced. So I will stretch out my hand and perform wonders and strike down the Egyptians. Then the king of Egypt will send you away.
But what if they don't believe me or listen to me? What if they say, the Lord didn't appear to you?
What is that in your hand?
A stick.
Throw it to the ground.
Moses threw the stick on the ground and it turned into a snake, and Moses jumped back.
Reach out your hand and pick up the tail.
Moses bent down and picked up the snake, and it was a stick again.
Do this to prove to the Israelites that the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you. Now, put your hand inside your clothes.
Moses put his hand inside his clothes, and when he took his hand out again, it was diseased, covered in white spots like leprosy.
Put your hand back inside your clothes again,
Moses put his hand inside his clothes again, and when he took it out, it was healthy, like the rest of his body.
If no one believes the first sign, they will believe the second sign. If they believe neither of these signs, take some water out of the Nile River and pour it on the ground. The water will turn immediately into blood.
But I've never been a confident speaker. I wasn't confident before you spoke to me. I'm certainly not confident now. I am slow at speaking. I stutter. I never know what to say.
Who makes people able to speak? Who makes them deaf or dumb? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, go. I will be with you. I will help you speak and tell you what to say.
Oh, please, Lord, send somebody else.
Your brother Aaron is a confident speaker. He is already on his way to you. You will tell Aaron what to say, and he will speak to the people for you. I will be with you, with your mouth, and with his mouth. And I will teach you what to do. Now, take your stick and go.
And Moses finally went.
What did you notice as you listened? What did you notice, and as you imagined that you were Moses standing there, how did you feel? How did you feel even about your life in Midian? Day after day, you and the sheep out there in the wilderness, alone with your thoughts, day after day. What do you think about? Do you miss the comforts, excitement, and sophistication of the Egyptian court? Or do you relish the simpler life? Are you grateful just to be alive and to be part of a growing family? Or are you frustrated? Nothing much happens out there in the wilderness. You're worried about your people. Are you impatient to get back to Egypt, to be part of the action, to be in the thick of things, to get involved? And then, what goes through your mind when you see that bush strangely burning yet not burning up? Are you curious? Why do you pause for a second look? How do you feel when you hear that voice? Moses, Moses, don't come any closer. Take off your sandals. You stand on holy ground. How quickly do you take off your shoes? How do you feel when God speaks about the misery of your people, slaves in Egypt? God has heard their cry, seen their oppression, knows their suffering. How do you then feel when God says that God has come down to save those Israelites, your people, to bring them out of Egypt into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey? How do you feel when God says, I have come down to save my people, so now you, Moses, you go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people out. Exodus reveals nothing about Moses' feelings through this episode. It tells us only what Moses says. Who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out? Now, in one sense, it's a rhetorical question, but it's dripping with context and subtext. Things are complicated. Moses has history with the Egyptians. Raised as a prince in Pharaoh's household, he's now wanted for murder and insurrection. Okay, the Pharaoh of that day is dead, but it's not like that past is going to be forgotten. So when Moses says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? He's saying, do you want to get me killed? If anyone you could send to Pharaoh, why me? And then if you think about it, if by some miracle God blinds the Egyptian court and nobody recognises Moses, after all, he's been out there in the desert getting sunburned for years, there's still Buckley's chance that Pharaoh will grant this shepherd an audience. The Egyptians despise shepherds, or hasn't God heard? Moses says, suppose I do go to the Israelites. What if they don't believe me? What if they won't listen to me? What if they say, the Lord did not appear to you? More questions laden with subtext. Things are complicated. Moses has history with the Israelites too. Born a Hebrew, yet raised in the court as an Egyptian prince. When Moses ran from Egypt, he did not look like an Israelite. He did not sound like an Israelite. And even now, he can't even speak Hebrew properly. The Israelites rejected his help in the past. Suppose I do go to the Israelites? In other words, why would the Israelites listen to me? If anyone you could send, why me? Moses says, I've never been a confident speaker, not then, not now. Did Moses have a speech impediment, a stutter, a stammer? We don't know for sure. Translated literally, he says, I am slow and heavy of speech and tongue. What does that mean? Had his infancy and childhood traumas affected his speech, his communication in some way? Possibly. Or was it that growing up between those two worlds, the worlds of Egypt and the world of the Hebrew slaves, was it that Moses spoke both languages awkwardly, with an accent and without ease, fluency and idiom? Possibly. Moses, out of objections, is still reluctant. Oh Lord, please send someone else. When you think about it, everything that complicates things for Moses, everything that makes that task ahead particularly dangerous, simultaneously equips him for the task. He grew up in the Egyptian court. He knows how it works. He's familiar with court protocols. He understands the language and can speak it, kind of. At the same time, nursed by his Hebrew mother, knowing his brothers and sister, Moses knows the history of his people. He's learnt their prayers, been instructed in their culture, seen their suffering, although not experienced it himself. He understands their language and can speak it, kind of. So there he is, pursued by the Egyptians, rejected by the Israelites, marginalised to both people, suspected by both people. But all this means that Moses can cross and can communicate across boundaries. He can be an intermediary to advocate and intercede. The real questions don't revolve around Moses. Who am I? What if they don't believe me? I can't even talk. The real questions revolve around God. Who God is, what God says, what God does, whom God calls. God sees the misery of his people, hears their cry, knows their suffering. God comes down to save, calls Moses, and promises to be with him. I will save my people. So Moses, you go. Moses' burning bush encounter is one small part of a much bigger story, a story in which many, many other people played pivotal roles. Looking at that story, those who believe in a non-interventionist God contend that the Israelites saved themselves and then made up a God story to explain what happened. On the other hand, those who believe in a highly interventionist God say that God did everything. The people, Moses and many others, they were just tools, puppets whose strings God pulled, pawns whom God moved around. But Exodus itself refuses such artificial distinctions. I have come down to save my people. So come, Moses, I send you to Pharaoh. Where does divine intervention end and human agency begin? Where does human agency end and divine intervention begin? It's not clear. It's almost never clear. That's the point. When God intervenes, God usually intervenes through people. God acted through the Exodus, sometimes spectacularly. But God's intervention did not make the many human participants of the Exodus story superfluous. They all played their part. God was with them. God worked through them. Now as then, God continues to usually intervene through people. So, when God appears silent in the face of injustice and unnecessary suffering, we might like to ask ourselves, is God inactive and silent? Or are we, God's people and others among God's people, not responding to God's call? What does all this say about hope? First, I suggest that it says that hope begins when we take notice, pause and tune into God's presence. Whether or not we notice the bush burning, whether or not we hear God's voice, we are always and everywhere in God's presence. Every step we've ever taken, every step we will ever take, is on holy ground. Second, hope begins with trust in God. God sees, hears, acts, calls, God knows. God is with us. Terrible situations and terrible suffering, they do not mean that God has forgotten his people, that God doesn't see or hear, that God doesn't care. It doesn't mean that God's promises are not true. God is with us. God does care. Third, I'd suggest that hope begins when we act on our trust in God, when we respond to God's call and go with God, trusting God to use us. Hope is not praying to God and then sitting back waiting for God to act. God usually acts through people, ordinary people, people with complicated pasts, people with issues, people with disabilities of many kinds, people who aren't very confident, people who are often reluctant. But God is with us. God is at work. God usually works through people. I have come down to save. Come, I will send you. We're coming up for a state election, and it's rather amazing that I've not mentioned that yet. So how might our hope influence our behaviour in this election? Well, it's obviously not up to me to tell you how to vote, but I have a suggestion about how we could remember that all the ground we walk on is sacred, holy ground, remember to trust God and know God is involved, and to act on that trust. When you have a candidate standing on your local shopping centre footpath, waiting to talk to people, or when you have one of their spruikers, maybe you could tell them something that concerns you about the way our state is run. There are many things, but think of something that the state government has the power to change. I don't know what your issue would be, but mine would be gambling, poker machines, and the dependence of the state for revenue that causes so much human suffering. Both sides of politics are involved in that and addicted to this source of revenue. I can't just sit back and pray about it and wait for God to do something. I can ask a question, I can make a comment, I can send an email. Hope begins when we recognise that God is present when we trust God, that God is involved, and when we act on that trust. Moses saw the bush, stopped, listened, took off his shoes. God said, "I have come down to save. Now come, I will send you. I will be with you. Now go." Jesus said, "Peace, shalom, be with you. As the Father sent me, so I send you." And he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit." So let us go from this place confident that Jesus goes with us, that the Spirit goes with us, and that God is with us wherever we go. Amen.